Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to Irregular Bitches, the sometimes expletive-laden midlife Always. Podcast for women of a certain age, a certain mood, a certain temperature, and very much of a certain time of life. Of that, we are certain. I'm Sarah Kaywood, mum, wax flogger, and former TV personality. Former? Maybe not. My esteemed co-host is Louise Mitchell, mum of teens, hypnotherapist extraordinaire, and kitchen mixologist. Louise, what's the newest cocktail specialty? Do we have one?
Well, I'm still wanging out the margaritas, love, in my Nutribullet. I haven't moved on from
them. Oh, I love it. You know what? Why? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, they are delicious. They are
delicious.
And I've been, that's how I've been drinking tequila since I had to stop doing tequila shots when I was at university, aged about 21. I am now 51 and I've started being able to do tequila shots again. Hooray!
What, because you have them in a margarita?
No, I can actually do a shot. So I've been drinking margaritas the entire time. But now I discovered this Christmas, when somebody offered me a tequila shot, gave it a go, nailed it, mate. So 30 years it's taken me and I'm back on the tequila shots.
She's back in the room. Why did you have to stop doing them at age 21?
Because we had a house party at university. We had pre-drinks before anybody knew about pre-drinks, before everybody else arrived. And and I had to go to bed. And when I woke up in the morning, not only did I wake up in my flatmate's bed, nothing happened, I was naked. And I couldn't find my clothes. And I found my clothes and they were in the washing machine where I had washed them, because apparently I had been ill and walked naked through the party to put my clothes in the washing machine.
No, Louise! That is horrific and brilliant all at the same time. Oh, but I bet you had. I bet the boys were like, banging bod.
I have no idea. I have no recollection. And I didn't drink tequila again for 30 years
So you were like, nobody's seeing that again. But at least, I love the fact that even in your drunken stupor, you were like, must wash vomit clothes.
Exactly.
Must wash vomit clothes.
I know. I got my priorities right. Didn't care about being naked. Must ensure I have clean clothes.
I love it. That is brilliant. On that note, should we crack on with today's guest?
Let's. When you asked me, I really toyed with, am I going to divulge this or not? And I thought, fuck it, why not?
You got it. It's brilliant. I absolutely love it.
Irregular Bitches.
Our guest today is a GP, women's health doctor, and registered member of the British Menopause Society. You can find her on Instagram as The Menopause Medic, busting menomyths, bringing the truth, advice, and a truly wonderful bedside manner. Well worth following for her no-nonsense advice and empathy. Oh, and she's going to tell us all about testosterone today and its role in all things midlife. Welcome, The Menopause Medic, Dr. Finula Barton.
Yay! Hello, ladies.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me. That was a wonderful introduction. I feel warm and fuzzy inside.
I am so excited. I've got so many questions to ask you, some of which you've actually already answered on WhatsApp for me, but I need to now share with a nation of midlifers. Definitely need to do that. Right. What can we plunder Finn for, Lou? What should we ask her?
Well, you've got testosterone at the top of your list, haven't you? And I've got a question I'd quite like to ask before you jump in, if that's all right.
Yeah, go for it.
Because I'm really interested to know why, when we first speak to our GP, the conversation is around, or certainly was for me, is around estrogen and progesterone. But we know that testosterone is in the mix too. So I was wondering why that isn't thrown in there initially, if you wouldn't mind explaining that, please.
So there's a couple of reasons. And the first one is, you know, lack of research and a slight reluctance to accept testosterone as part of sort of mainstream hormone replacement therapy. I think, you know, testosterone has always been seen as the male hormone. And even though, you know, subspecialist doctors have always known that it was important for female reproductive and other health and wellness markers, it's only really sort of fairly recently become more commonplace and well known about. And as a result, there hasn't been any big, you know, large scale randomized control trials looking at what testosterone therapy, you know, benefits and what the risks and all of those things are. We have got a wealth of what we would call anecdotal and retrospective data. So information that we've gathered from clinicians who've been using testosterone therapy for several years. But that's not as strong evidence as some of the bigger sort of trials and things that we have around estrogen and progesterone hormone replacement therapy. There is actually a part of the NICE guidance, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, which kind of provides evidence-based guidance for all medical practitioners, not just general practitioners. And, you know, in the menopause management section, there is reference to testosterone and its potential benefits. But what's suggested based on the research is that the most important hormone to replace from a symptom perspective and from a long-term health and longevity perspective is the estrogen. So it makes most sense to get that on track first.
Okay.
So that you can make sure that somebody's adequately replaced with that, with the safeguards of the progesterone alongside it for those women who need progesterone. And then once somebody is sort of stabilised and replete in sufficient estrogen, if there are still ongoing issues, and specifically the recommended indication for using testosterone is for something called female androgen deficiency syndrome, which is a loss of libido, difficulty with sexual arousal, combined with a low blood testosterone level or free androgen index. And so if a woman has, you know, been using estrogen and progesterone for a long time but still has those residual symptoms, that's the only recommended indication for using testosterone in, you know, during perimenopause and menopause. And so I think that just hasn't filtered down yet into common practice. The other big issue is there aren't any licensed testosterone products for women in the UK. And for a GP to prescribe something, sign their signature to a prescription, mm-hmm. actually what we prefer to do is prescribe licensed medications and drugs, because we know that there's less risk associated with those. Because we don't have a licensed testosterone product, it actually then involves quite a lot of clinical risk. And if a clinician doesn't really fully understand the pros, cons, etc., and can't counsel their patient effectively, then they shouldn't be prescribing testosterone because it wouldn't be appropriate.
That makes perfect sense.
A lot of women you and I have mentioned this before, a lot of women will be like, but that's a male hormone. So can you explain for the Luddites amongst us exactly what testosterone does in women? Because we have testosterone, don't we? Obviously.
We do. So, you know, in our reproductive years, we often produce more testosterone in our in menstrual cycles than we do estrogen. And it's a really important hormone for reproductive and sexual functions. So it's an important hormone for regulating the reproductive cycle and thus our reproductive potential. It's also really important during our reproductive years for maintaining normal bone and muscle strength. It can also be really important for maintaining normal cognitive function, normal mental health. And we've got testosterone receptors in all various different parts of the body, which would indicate that it also has a role in things like oral health, skin health, eye health, gastrointestinal health, and urological health. So that, you know, the bladder and the bowel and all of those sort of things. But we still don't have a huge amount of research into the effects of testosterone in women. We've got a lot more data supporting the use of that hormone as a replacement hormone in men. But we know that we produce it during our reproductive years. We know that we become deficient in it from about our mid-30s, or not deficient in it. Testosterone levels tend to start falling from about our mid-30s and then generally fall over time until they become quite deplete or deficient in our sort of late 40s and early 50s. And so a lot of the benefits that I see of women using testosterone who've been prescribed it for, you know, loss of libido symptoms, actually the benefits that they enjoy are often far greater than that purely reproductive or sexual function, you know, element. And often people will find that their clarity of thought has improved, their brain fog has lifted, their mood is more stable, they feel less anxious, they're second guessing themselves less, they're able to make decisions much more quickly and easily, but also they tend to feel stronger, they tend to be able to maintain their weight a little bit more reasonably, which would suggest that testosterone has a role in metabolism, mm-hmm. which we know it does. And yeah, so generally there are lots more kind of benefits to using testosterone than we have, you know, fully defined as yet. And I hope this is something that, you know, in the future we'll have more data, more research to support, so that more clinicians can be prescribing it early on, mm-hmm. rather than it being something that we can only get when we see a specialist. Yeah,
doesn't it? It sounds like it's a miracle hormone. Would we need a blood test for that?
Yes. So because it's something that we don't know as much about, because it's something that hasn't got a licensed medication for it, it's best to be more careful when we're prescribing testosterone for women. And it's important to make sure that we are actually treating something appropriately. So women may have loss of libido, but as we know, that isn't something that's always purely biological. So loss of sexual desire and issues around intimacy can often be multifactorial, and there can be biological, social, circumstantial and psychological factors that can impact that. So one of the big things is to make sure that actually that symptom coincides with a biological measure of low testosterone, or what we do is we measure something called free androgen index, which is the amount of testosterone that's actually freely available in the blood that can be then used by the cells. And if the free androgen index is low and somebody has symptoms, then it would be recommended. And then we also need to monitor blood tests on treatment. So normally I would repeat the blood tests within the first 3 months of somebody being on testosterone therapy. And then if everything stays within normal range, repeat that test on an annual basis, just to make sure that we're not ending up with levels getting too high and women coming to harm as a result of the levels getting too high.
Well, that's what I was going to say, like, because I think most women will go, I'm not going to take testosterone, my voice will break. But those things don't happen, yeah. No?
Yeah, they can. And I think that's why we have to be careful about
it. Right, okay, so that can happen.
If a woman actually doesn't have low testosterone, if they've got symptoms, but the symptoms aren't actually due to low blood testosterone levels, and then you add testosterone in, you run the risk of them then having too much testosterone and them having symptoms of androgen excess. And you know, one of the symptoms that can often develop when we've got too much androgen or testosterone in the bloodstream is it can have an impact on the vocal cords, so the voice can deepen, and that's something that's irreversible. So if that happens as a result of being on testosterone therapy, that can be difficult to then come back.
I did not know that.
And that's why we have to be careful to give it in low dose and to make sure that we monitor as we go along. The other one is, you know, developing spots. So lots of sort of oilier skin, oilier mm-hmm. hair, spots to the face. People do sometimes notice a change in the thickness or in the colour of their soft downy hair. So, you know, we've all got that sort of soft downy mm-hmm. hair on the face. Sometimes that can start to change. That tends to be quite a late change. You know, you're not going to just sprout a beard overnight. It's something that will happen gradually and slowly over time.
Right.
You know, and that's why we just need to... that's why prescribers need to be aware of all these things, that you can have that discussion yeah. with patients before they then make an informed decision about whether they want to go down that route or not.
I have two stubborn, very dark black chin hairs that can literally appear overnight. And if I haven't really inspected my face in the morning, I can be walking around with those bad boys. I did not want those to grow.
Lou,
I do not want
have they got names? They need to have names. What are their names? well, Bill and Ben, that's it. Bob and Rob.
So that can often be actually a symptom of low estrogen. So then relatively, if you've got lower estrogen and you've got normalish testosterone, you can then, you know, you can end up developing those, you know, one or two recalcitrant dark hairs that sort of are a bit of a nemesis, and that's another thing that can actually be an estrogen deficient symptom. So many of the symptoms can overlap, which is why it's important that women have access to, you know, a clinician who can take all of that into account. And rather than it, you know, unfortunately, frustratingly, within the NHS at the moment, you know, you often only have a short appointment to discuss one or maybe two issues at a time. And, you know, discussing your irritating facial hair might not be top of the list when you're going in to speak about all the other symptoms you're experiencing in perimenopause and menopause, which are often, you know, really debilitating.
Yeah, I can cope with my two chin hairs.
Irregular.
Bitches.
Lou did the, what's it called again, the test?
The wee test.
Yeah, what's Dutch it called?
Test. That's it.
Dutch. That's it, the Dutch test, the dried urine test. And did she say that, did that come back as oestrogen deficient?
No, did it not? Came back that I had high oestrogen and I needed to take a supplement to clear it.
Okay.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But then I would say that my next question to Finn would then be, throughout the menopause, perimenopause and menopause journey, can things change? So Lou had her Dutch test probably getting on for a year ago. Can things change on that journey through to postmenopausal?
Absolutely. And that's why in some ways, actually, any kind of testing in perimenopause can be sometimes not hugely valuable, because the nature of the beast in perimenopause is that you're still ovulating. That may be regularly or it may be becoming irregular, but if you're ovulating, you will be producing some estrogen, and that will tend to peak in the early part of your cycle, as the estrogen is being produced by the maturing follicles in the ovary, and then that will start to decline after ovulation, and then you'll get a rise in progesterone levels. Now, if there's a disruption in that kind of normal process in any way, so if you haven't got a huge number of follicles left, so there's only a few of them maturing compared to previously, you might not produce as much estrogen. Actually, there will be probably cycles where you have a normal number of follicles and therefore you might produce a normal amount of estrogen. There may be cycles where you're producing lots more estrogen or relatively less progesterone. So in perimenopause, what we often see are these big fluctuations where you can have high levels and low levels, but the gradual sort of trend is that over time those levels are declining because they're going on that downward path, but there is lots of fluctuations in the meantime. So if you test somebody during a cycle where their estrogen levels are high, it can then be quite misleading because, you know, Lou, you could be going through the next three or four years thinking actually you're estrogen dominant, when in actual fact it was just a blip that was picked up. Likewise, when we do blood tests and such like in perimenopausal women, often we'll have very low estrogen levels and we give estrogen back. But actually that isn't always hugely reliable because, you know, 2 weeks down the line, they might have a higher level of estrogen. And so there is all this fluctuation, which does make it frustratingly unscientific, I think, to a lot of people. They're like, well, hang on a minute.
It makes it a fucking minefield. A fucking minefield.
You took the words out of my mouth.
I mean, it's just a nightmare. I mean, because, and Lou, you know, it was the Dutch testers, it is brilliant, but who can afford to have that every 6 months? You'd be bankrupt.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely not. It was not.
And a big part of that is why, you know, NICE, the British Menopause Society, don't recommend actually using tests like that, because you know, what is the advantage? What is the value? What's much more valuable is actually listening to somebody to find out what their symptoms are, because often actually if you get that full picture from a history, from the symptoms someone's experiencing and the journey they've been on, then actually you can get a much better idea of what's likely to be going on. And yes, you may well have been estrogen dominant at that time, and I think it's important to go through the process of making sure that your body is equipped as well as it can be to make sure that it's excreting excess hormone effectively. But there may also be times when your estrogen is deficient or low, and that might be giving rise to a different set of symptoms. And the idea behind hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone therapy, as it's now being called, is that if we can boost your levels to a certain sort of minimum baseline, it means that you don't then have those big dips, which can often be the most debilitating part of symptomology. And so if we just sort of stop you from getting too low, there will probably be times when you are okay or fine with your natural hormone levels. And I see that quite a lot. You know, a lot of perimenopausal women will say, I feel better, but there's still these fluctuations. And I think that's normal. You know, one of the positives, if you can see it as a positive, is actually when you've then gone through perimenopause and you've become menopausal, you're not fluctuating anymore. You've become, you know, your estrogen is no longer being produced in high quantity from the ovaries. And so it can often make managing symptoms a lot more straightforward, because it tends to be a kind of long-standing low level of hormones that you're treating rather than these big fluctuations that we see in perimenopause.
Sweet freedom.
I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Sweet freedom.
And that's the difficult thing, isn't it? You think, gosh, am I now looking forward to that? That's a strange thing to be considering.
I am. Although I have to say,
so
going
it can
back,
be a freedom.
Yeah, well, going back to the sex thing, because, you know, my husband edits this, so I have to sort of self-edit as I go along, otherwise he'll be like, really, Sarah, I really have to put that out there. But we've got children who are 8 and 10. We're both really busy. I get excited to get into bed at night because I want to read a magazine and he wants to read a book. And I don't think, and this is my other theory, and Lou knows this, I've got a theory that the longer women go without sex, the less they want it. And the longer that men go without sex, the more they want it. And therein lies the rub, no pun intended. And so it's sometimes not just testosterone, it's just life. But I do also think...
It's life.
And Lou will be the one to tell me this, that you, because she's very good about making sure she makes time for Duncan. You know, she makes time for intimacy. And I think that too often perimenopausal women just go, it's so low down the list of priorities, they just let it slide. Okay. And before you know it, you've got a flatmate, not a husband or a lover.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing to discuss actually when we're talking about libido loss, because it's very easy for, you know, to become medicalized and become something that needs to be treated with a medication. But as you've just heard, there are potential pitfalls to using testosterone, and actually I think when you're experiencing a symptom like loss of libido or loss of sexual desire or difficulty with arousal, it's important to consider it from all different angles. And is there, you know, circumstantial issues? And if it's something that you want to nurture and nourish, actually, Lou's right, you do need to actually make time for it. But that can be a really difficult thing to do if your priorities are that long to-do list. You've got to the end of the long to-do list and then you just want to go to sleep, because actually, you know, if you don't sleep, then tomorrow is going to feel worse. And where do you then slot it in? And so there is an element of you have to use it or lose it. I hate that phrase, but, you know, actually, unless your body's being reminded of how good it can feel to be touched intimately or to feel sensual and sexual, it's not going to then mount that response to seek that again. You do have to sort of remind the body of how brilliant it can feel and that great big surge of dopamine that you get with an orgasm. And, you know, if you can't make time to do it with your partner, it's fine to make time to do it on your own, so that then actually you do feel like you're in the mood to be intimate with your partner when, you know, when your timetables collide and you can actually enjoy that time together. So, and I think the same could be said, you know, of men. Like, I think it if there's a difficulty, there's a mismatch, and this is what they often talk about, that, you know, in sex therapy, that there can often be this enormous mismatch with sexual desire. Mm. And it's about both parties coming back from that using all different strategies. But it's a really interesting, you know, aspect and part of medicine, and it's something that, you know, is incredibly common in the group of women that I spend time helping. But it isn't ever a simple, straightforward hormonal issue.
So can I just say, because you just mentioned at the end of the very long to-do list, that the irregular bitches are now saying, ladies, this one, number one on the to-do list, have a wank. Number one on the to-do list, have a little bit of, well, have a little bit of a tickle. Go on.
Yeah.
Get a, what's, you know, get a rabbit out.
She has a way with words, doesn't she?
Poetic.
Let's all wank. Wank, wank, wank. It's really good.
Man's
for you.
It is really good. Out. I can't cope with it.
What, really?
I don't want one. I can't cope with five.
I'm going to say five more. Did you know you can get clit suckers?
Did you know that?
I only found out the other day. Every day's a school day. You can actually get, like, vibrators that one bit goes inside you and the other bit gently sucks on your clitoris. There you go.
Well, this is the thing. There's all these amazing products. I think that we need to be more open about.
Yes.
There shouldn't be any shame or stigma in wanting sexual pleasure. And what's also another thing to bear in mind is actually having a good orgasm, it does, you know, then sort of set off this cascade of quite incredible neuro and endocrine messages through the brain and body that can be really helpful to get you off to sleep. So actually, if you're really struggling to get to sleep and your husband's snoring next to you, give them a nudge and say, actually, I need some help getting to sleep, please.
I don't know a husband alive that's going to say no. Do you?
Exactly. Because they have very responsive sexual desire. So, you know, as soon as they get that sort of, you know, visual or audible cue that it might happen, you know, the mechanism that then works within their body is almost instantaneous. But for women,
hard on,
you know, that process of feeling aroused can rely upon several other factors, and that's why there is another bit of a mismatch when it comes to heterosexual intimacy, certainly.
See, I've got a little bit of advice on the back of that.
Go on then, Lee.
Sometimes just get started.
Yes.
Just get started. You may not be crawling the walls thinking, oh, I'm mad for this. But once you get started, it doesn't take that long to get into it. And it may be not very high on your priority list, but sometimes I think it does need to be prioritised. So that's my bit of advice. Just start.
And taking little opportunities during the day as well, like to just touch your partner, like, you know, or kiss them and be affectionate, because that will then often, you know, give rise to building or mounting desire that then helps in terms of wanting to take anything a little bit further. So yeah, those little things, those kisses on the lips, or, you know, brushing past and a squeeze on the bottom, or not suggesting anyone should grape anybody, by the way, but you just know those intimate moments with your partner.
Andy loves to have a little cup. It walked past me, have a little cup. I'm like, oh, I used to say to people that did that back in the 90s, because it did used to happen, I used to say, don't touch what you can't afford.
Isn't that tragic, though? I think we probably all got stories from when we were growing up, not necessarily as empowered as we are now, and had to experience that kind of thing. And I suspect that obviously in the entertainment industry, it was prolific.
Oh, yeah. I mean, can you imagine anyone... Do you have daughters, Finn? Well, can you imagine? And Lola and I have, so we all have daughters. Can you imagine our daughters putting up with that? Autumn was seriously, somebody's going to get a right hook if they even go anywhere near her. She is feisty.
Lola would also literally take anyone out, literally.
But also, they know.
We put up with it.
It's like, oh, this is what happens when you're at work. I mean, I've got a list as long as your arm of really inappropriate behaviour to, you know, me in my 20s. And like you say, Sarah, I'm sure yours was even worse.
Well, that was, well, I mean, I wasn't just joking. That was my stock answer. That was my stock answer for making light of the situation, but getting out of it was, don't touch what you can't afford. And then I would try and extricate myself. So all joking aside, but yeah, the times have changed. Yes, and for that, we are forever grateful. Speaking of times changing, Finn.
Yes.
I've got to ask you about drinking, because this is a very new thing, But and Lou knows about this because she'll say, did you have a nice time last night? I'll be like, yeah, it was lovely. Drank a bit too much, woke up this morning, threw up. I never, or sometimes I don't even get drunk. I have three drinks and I just feel a bit sicky and have to go to bed. What the fuck is happening?
So we don't really know exactly why it happens, but it is really common that people become increasingly intolerant to alcohol during, particularly during perimenopause. And it's less so postmenopausally in my, you know, in my experience. So a lot of my postmenopausal women actually don't have a problem with hangovers at all.
Right.
So there's another silver lining
again,
there.
Something else to look forward to, yeah. Bring it on.
There's when our hormones are fluctuating and we've got highs and we've got lows in terms of estrogen, what it can do is it can have a negative impact on things like your gastrointestinal tract. So actually your gut might be, you know, more sensitive or less sensitive. It might be able to process that alcohol less well, and that's one impact. Another thing that can happen when estrogen levels are fluctuating is that our body's histamine response changes. So histamine is a really powerful chemical that's released from some of our blood cells in response to, you know, external stimuli. And it's most common in allergic responses. So, for example, you get an insect bite and you get that big red rash, you know, or swelling area around the insect bite because the blood has gone there and released lots of histamine into the local area. And it gets swollen and it gets red and it gets sore. What can happen during perimenopause is our histamine response becomes hyperactive. So drinking things like alcohol, or a really common one is people becoming intolerant to things like gluten and dairy, consuming those products then triggers this histamine response. So you get swelling and you get fluid in the lining of the gut, which means then the gut isn't functioning properly. You're not clearing things properly, and therefore you're more likely to feel unwell as a result. So that's mechanism number two. Another mechanism is that actually estrogen levels, or alcohol, can actually increase estrogen levels. So when you're consuming alcohol, what we tend to see is that increases estrogen. So if you're using HRT, for example, or you're at a part of your cycle where your estrogen is pretty good, and then you have loads of alcohol, what might be happening is then you've got too much estrogen. And then, of course, what you're going to have is a big downer from it when the estrogen is then out of your system, which can then sometimes give rise to really profound estrogen deficient symptoms like the hot sweats and the anxiety and the doom and gloom and just feeling absolutely wretched. So it's ultimately, the short answer to that question is because of the fluctuating hormones, but there's a number of different mechanisms that sort of contribute to it. I think what's important is that, you know, you perhaps listen to your body, and actually if your body's telling you that alcohol isn't making you feel good, then, you know, trying to, you know, reduce, cut out, or maybe change the alcohol that you're drinking. A lot of people find that they get this response when they're drinking certain types of alcohol, so things like red or white wine.
Wine, Lou and I like wine.
And often it's the sulfites or, you know, the additives that goes into those sort of things that can be what's generating the response. So, you know, if you enjoy drinking alcohol and you don't want to cut down or cut out, then think about just trying different types of alcohol. So things like a gin and tonic, for example, you might tolerate much better than a glass of wine. But just bear in mind, try not to drink more than 14 units a week, which is obviously the recommended maximum for women. But also bear in mind that actually alcohol itself can give rise to lots of biological stress in the body, which might in turn make, you know, menopausal or perimenopausal symptoms worse. Mm. It can often make our sleep disrupted, which can then have a terrible effect the following day. And you know, alcohol too frequently can have a negative impact on our liver, on our metabolism, on our weight management, all of that sort of thing. It can also push blood pressure up. So, you know, I wouldn't ever advocate that, you know, people drink too much. But, you know, if you're having problems with it, it's worthwhile thinking about, you know, what it could be that's contributing and thinking about making changes accordingly.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely cut down now on my drinking. And because also what you just said about being allergic to dairy, Lou knows that I'm now slightly lactose intolerant. And I had a bowel resection about 7 years ago, so that doesn't help with any of these things. So no. My gastrointestinal tract is slightly sensitive anyway. But I was under the illusion it was some sort of enzyme that we are become deficient in. Is that not the case? Is it more a hormone thing?
No, you still have the enzyme, but I suppose, you know, if you're getting more of that alcohol into your bloodstream for whatever reason, the enzyme might be overwhelmed. You know, it's more likely to do with the hormone levels itself, and the impact that they have on your body's immune and gastrointestinal response.
And actually, that makes sense, doesn't it, Lou? Because you can feel much worse at different times. You'll go, I was fine last week and I got absolutely obliterated. That's and true. Then I had two drinks last night and I felt terrible. So it's probably to do with where you are in your cycle and where the hormones are.
Anyway, where you are in your cycle, you know, what you've had to eat and drink beforehand, you know, whether you've, you know, already got a bit of sensitivity in your gastrointestinal tract before you go, and the alcohol that you've chosen to consume, it can, you know, it can all have an impact.
Irregular
bitches.
Could we talk about people who can't take HRT now? Because I'm conscious that does affect a lot of people for a lot of, you know, different reasons. A couple of my friends fall into that category, and they're always saying, oh, you know, it's so easy for most people. They just go to the doctor and take HRT. Yeah, that's easy. So I wondered if you had any sort of take homes that we could give for people that can't use HRT, please.
So I feel quite strongly and passionately that HRT isn't the only answer. Even for women who use HRT, it is very rarely the only answer, because as we talked about earlier, it's very unlikely that it's just hormone changes that are the problem here. It's those hormone changes in the context of cultural, social and circumstantial and psychological circumstances, you know. So I think it's important to take all of those symptoms and actually think about what element of this could be biological, what element could be extrinsic, and if there are ways to manage those extrinsic aspects of a symptom, then think about addressing those. I think it's hugely important that you get the sort of four pillars of health and well-being robustly in place, whether you choose or are allowed to take HRT for perimenopause and menopause or not. And they are, first of all, actually one of the most important things to do is make sure that you're staying fit and active, because if you're exercising on a regular basis, actually you're supporting your body in a whole range of ways, but you're also going to help to sort of navigate the transition probably a little bit, you know, more evenly. And at this stage, I would suggest it's not all about doing cardio anymore. It's about changing up your routine, doing things that actually make you feel good and makes your body feel happy and releases endorphins, rather than your exercising for punishment or weight loss or anything like that. So it can often be helpful to think about picking up some weights at this point. So thinking about weight training, start with light weights, take some, you know, tuition, don't just start swinging weights around for no reason on your own, which is what I did and pulled my back recently. But also things like Pilates, which are really good for connecting the mind and the body, and also strengthening all those core muscles that we're going to need to keep us upright and strong and tall as we move through our later years. And also anything that's kind of resistance work and weight bearing is really beneficial for our bone mineral density. So it helps to reduce the risk of developing estrogen-related bone mineral density loss, osteopenia and osteoporosis, which is a big problem, particularly in those who can't use HRT, because we do tend to lose bone mineral density sort of, you know, on a rapid basis throughout our 40s and into our 50s. So exercise, I think, is an absolute, you know, first thing to consider for whether you're taking HRT or not, but particularly in women who can't use HRT. The other thing is nutrition. And, I, you know, I'm going to stay in my lane here. I'm not a nutritionist, but there are loads of things that we can do within our diet and what we consume that can really help to support us in a nice way. It might be worthwhile people, you know, looking up a nutritionist, looking at some, you know, specific information around that. But again, some basics and making sure that you're getting lots of omega-3s in the diet to help with your cognitive function and your cardiovascular health, making sure that you're eating a rainbow of colours. So the more colours we get through the diet in terms of fruits and vegetables, the more antioxidants we have, the better immune systems we have, the more balanced our hormones are. Making sure that you're getting plenty of protein. So, you know, our hormones, you know, are only as good as the stuff that they're made of and the cells that they can help. And if you've not got enough protein going in, then the body doesn't function very well. Making sure you've got plenty of water. So, you know, often I find at this stage in life, when we've got the long to-do list and we're at the bottom of it, one of the things people forget is to drink enough water. Make sure you're drinking enough to make sure that your urine is a clear sort of light straw colour, and that means that you're well hydrated, and when your cells are well hydrated they will work better. Then one of the other things to consider are using sort of foods that are rich in phytoestrogens. Phytoestrogens aren't estrogens. They're not going to have an estrogenic effect. They don't cause or trigger breast cancer in any way. But what they can do is they can kind of slightly sort of partially, you know, help in terms of boosting some of those estrogen deficient symptoms. So things like tofu and tempeh, a lot of the sort of foods that we see people in, you know, the Far East eating on a regular basis, where actually the experience of menopause and perimenopause is very different to what we experience in Western culture. So it's interesting to think about that. So exercise, nutrition, stress reduction. So I did a post a couple of months ago on my Instagram about, you know, is it stress or is it perimenopause? And actually, it's really hard to unpick, because our stress response has a direct response on our female reproductive hormones. And actually, when you're chronically stressed, or when you're very stressed but on an intermittent basis, that can inhibit your reproductive hormones, and it can actually stop you ovulating. If you don't ovulate, you don't produce estrogen. So when we're stressed, it can actually give rise to estrogen deficient symptoms. And so you don't know sometimes which is the chicken and which is the egg. In that situation, if you're not able to take HRT to help balance that out, then really connecting and finding ways to manage any stressful stimuli, a lot of which are extrinsic and you might not have control over, but it's about finding different coping mechanisms. So I think talking therapy can be really helpful in this instance, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, but anything that helps to downregulate the stress response. So a lot of people like acupuncture, reflexology. I really enjoy my Pilates and yoga practice from this perspective, because it really helps me to center and to feel you know, more connected from a mind-body perspective. Going for a walk in nature is a very good thing to relax you and to keep you sort of centered and grounded in the earth. One of the other things that there's been lots of popular, I suppose, opinion about recently is cold water therapy or cold immersion therapy. When we immerse ourselves in cold water, or when we expose ourselves to cold water in a safe way, what that does is it really triggers our parasympathetic nervous system, which then directly inhibits your sympathetic nervous system. And it's the sympathetic nervous system that mounts the stress response. So by doing things like regularly, you know, outdoor cold water swimming, for example, or what I tend to do is just have 15 to 30 seconds of cold water at the end of my shower, it can just really help to stimulate and balance those two sort of antagonistic parts of our central nervous system. But yeah, talking therapy can be really good at this stage, because we've often got quite a lot that needs to be unpacked, or that we're carrying around with us, and actually causes us to feel perpetually stressed. The fourth pillar is sleep, which is in itself a complete difficult one to do. But if you've got the other three pillars in place, you're more likely to get that fourth pillar in place too. But it is often, I think, the hardest thing to get back. But I don't know about you, but if you've ever worked night shifts, you know, I would regularly be on the tube on the way home from an early night shift, and people would look at me as if I was a drunk, because I just couldn't function. I was all over the place, and I hadn't had a drop of alcohol. I'd just been awake all night. And I think that for me, that reminds me of how detrimental not sleeping on a regular basis can become. It just destroys your energy levels. It really impacts your brain fog. It can have a really negative effect on things like your mood, your anxiety levels, your ability to cope. And it is, I think, the trickiest thing to get right. But if you can work hard on getting your sleep right, then if you can get all four of those pillars in place, by and large, I think most people will survive without HRT. But it's just how accessible and how achievable getting that all of those things in place are, because it's quite a lot of work, it's quite a lot of effort to get everything on track.
I mean,
and
I think
you know, you end up micromanaging your life, which is pretty boring and stressful. So it's all about it's about balance. But that's what I normally go through with women who can't use HRT. But there are also lots of other medicines that can really help that aren't HRT. And I think that they've often been given a bad rap. Antidepressants, you know, are a really helpful form of medication that are completely safe and that really help with sleep disturbance. They can massively help with anxiety and low mood symptoms. But big studies have also indicated that some of the antidepressant medications can also be really helpful for the vasomotor symptoms, the hot flushes and the sweats. So they're a really important part of menopause care, both for women who can take HRT and for women who can't. For breast cancer survivors, for example, there are other options, oxybutynin, amitriptyline, gabapentin, and there are going to be more drugs coming on the market in the not too distant future that can be helpful for those women too. So it's never I hate to ignore that group of people because I think that they're really important.
Yeah.
But there are lots of things that you can do.
Yeah.
Thank
and
you.
I think the uncomfortable truth, I think, really, with everything that you, if you're struggling, because some people sail through their perimenopause and menopause, or even mental health, yeah. I think the uncomfortable truth is it starts with you. You've got to sort of make changes. You can't just carry on eating junk food, drinking too much, not exercising, and allowing stress to take over and expect to pop a pill or take a supplement and make it all better. And that's one of the things I'm not preaching. That's one of the things that I have had a massive transformational journey over the last 3 to 4 years, realizing how much of an impact my former lifestyle was having on my mental health, my marriage, my relationship with my children. And Finn, I can't tell you, Lou knows this, I am like a different person because I had a word with myself and I had to stop doing things.
Like you said,
I had to start doing others. Yeah.
Irregular bitches.
So I am sleep deprived most of the time at the moment while I try and get everything sorted out. What is the few things that I really can't be asked to do? I can't be asked to eat properly. I can't be asked to exercise. I'm not prioritizing myself in a positive way. I'm very much very lethargic. And trying to make the effort to cook decent meals. Particularly because my teenagers now pretty much aren't in the house, so I haven't even got them as an excuse, because I did use them as an excuse to eat more healthily. So I am doing some things, like I am making myself eat more fruit and berries and that sort of thing, because that's a really quick, easy solution.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not being too hard on myself, because I am working on getting, everything, the holistic approach, isn't it? Looking at everything.
Yeah.
And so I'm being kind to myself and saying, you're not going to eat like crap and lounge around the whole time, all the time, but just in the meantime, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. And do you know what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to prioritise yoga. I'm going to prioritise yoga. It's mental health and it's movement, and I'm going to bloody do it, and I'm going to stop talking about it.
And that's the thing in Catelyn Moran's book. She talks about the never-ending to-do list. And a couple of times Finn says, when you get to the end of the to-do list, I don't know what yours looks like, Finula, but mine doesn't end.
It just rolls into tomorrow.
But Catelyn Moran always talks about how the last thing on your to-do list is start yoga or go to yoga, and it's the thing that she never gets around to doing, and it just made me laugh so much. It's that is the thing, and yet that is so important. Yoga's a brilliant thing
that should
for
be
us to do.
At the top.
At
so the movement piece should be at the top. And do you know what? I agree with you. I think it is quite hard to roll that mat out and get started. But in the same way that we were talking about intimacy earlier, it's just about getting started.
Yes.
So often if you keep your expectations low and you just say, do you know what? I'm going to lie down and I'm going to do a Savasana for a minute. Everyone.
What was that?
Savasana, when you just lie flat and you just breathe.
Oh, I can do that.
It's like, it's the most relaxed of the yoga poses. But there's no pressure with that, is there? And then if you've got your mat out and you lie down on it for a minute, the chances are you're then going to want to go and do a little bit more. My point being that instead of sort of setting yourself up to say, I'm going to do an hour of yoga every morning before I start my day, I think that's a big thing to take off. But if you say, I'm going to do, 5 minutes, in the morning before I have my shower, or 5 minutes on the floor before I get into bed at night, starting to put those little tweaks, those little habit stacks into your life, they will start to pay off. Sometimes I think the easiest thing to do is to go out for a walk. It doesn't take any effort, and often getting outside, moving your body, you can go as fast or as slow as you want. You don't need a dog often helps to stop you looking a bit odd, but being outside in nature, seeing the sky, breathing in air, taking some deep lungfuls of breath can actually be an incredibly powerful moving meditation, because you can then listen to the birds, listen to the rustle of the leaves, and kind of focus on other things rather than a lot of the things that are kind of whirring around your mind. So from an insomnia perspective, actually doing 5 minutes of just some gentle breathing rather than saying you're going to do a full-blown yoga class, or going out for an evening walk, might be a nice thing to do before then, settling down with your book and all of those other things that I'm sure you already do. And magnesium can really help. And I you're probably on some already, but magnesium supplements can sometimes be helpful. Yeah.
I'm really trying.
The other thing I think that perhaps we mentioned this before we started recording, but I think the to-do list, the fabled to-do list, we can never get to the end of it. I think that's one of the problems with midlife, is that it's overwhelming, the amount of stuff that we've got to do. And you know what I've started doing, which I found quite revelatory? I've started giving myself a break for not baking a cake, for not finishing the crochet I started. I still can't really, I mean, I can crochet, but rudimentary. I wanted to get really good at it. I learned how to do it. I stopped. And the other thing that we did recently was we finally got rid of the greenhouse, because it used to laugh at me. I'd come out and it would go, ha ha, you're not going to grow fruit, bitch. And so I said to Andy, let's just make the garden bigger. And because I can't keep looking at that thing and thinking one day I will grow tomatoes, because it was making me feel less. Do you know what I mean? And making me feel really stressed. So it's gone now. And when I'm retired, and I say this, and when the kids have gone, it won't happen then either. But maybe my pipe dream will be to have a greenhouse full of homegrown stuff, and you know, I'll be horticulturally.
Just not now. Just not now.
I know.
I think you've removed it. I think that's brilliant. Yeah, I just think it's out of your sight.
And just, it is prioritizing the to-do list, isn't it? What's on there that, you know, if there's something that's looking at you and laughing, just take it off. If it's not, you know, life or death, just take it off.
Or delegate it. Because that's my biggest problem, is I keep them all on my list. And I actually thought this morning, I was like, I'm just going to give this task to you, because you're A, better equipped to do it, and B, have masses of time. But I'm very reluctant to do that, because in my midlife, I have developed a need to be in control. But actually letting go of that control and letting other people take responsibility for things is a big thing. But I think one of the other reasons why the to-do list is such an issue is that we've got so much more on it because we are so more connected. So if we think about to how our mothers perhaps experienced their perimenopause and menopause journeys, they weren't exposed to the entire world through a little app on their connected mobile phone on a minute by minute basis. They weren't being bombarded with images of midlife women growing a great big greenhouse full of bountiful fruit and vegetables. It didn't even cross their mind that that was something that they should be on their list. You know, they were. And I think that there is an element of that, is that we are so bombarded and exposed to these kind of images and expectations. And I don't think it's anyone's fault necessarily, but we can often internalise that and put that on our list. And actually, it doesn't necessarily need to be a priority. But, you know, if it's something that you enjoy, if you enjoy growing fruit and vegetable and you enjoy crocheting, then it should be quite high up on that list. But it's just impossible to put that there sometimes, isn't it? Anyway. Yeah.
Oh, love it.
I don't think I have anything like that on my list.
Well, that's because you're better than me. It's because I have. I'm not even a perfectionist. I love the idea of. I'm basically a 70-year-old woman trapped in a 50-year-old body, and I want to garden, and I want to crochet, and I want to bake, and I want to do all those things, and I can't because I've got four jobs and two young children and Lou's about to move house, and you know, it's just chaos in an organized way. But that's why I just think, and then that, and mindfulness is another thing, is just enjoy the chaos, sort of embrace the children growing up and having to go to school or sending them off to university or moving house or improving your house. Embrace all that, because who knows what tomorrow is going to bring, and I might never get to grow my tomatoes, so I'm going to make damn sure I enjoy the journey on the way there. Do you know what I mean? So,
well, just reduce your expectations. Get one of those little bucket pots that you can just throw outside the back door.
That's a great idea.
Instead of having a full-blown greenhouse and going big,
that's a great idea, Sarah.
I mean,
you can prove yourself that you can do it.
Yeah, I mean,
don't talk to me about dying plants.
I have grown tomatoes. The crop of green tomato chutney that I made was epic.
Amazing.
Listen, we should let Finn go because she's got to crack on with that list.
I've got to get on with it.
Oh, thank you so much. You are awesome, and I feel properly like you've answered loads of questions that I had. So I'm really grateful. Thank you very much.
Me too.
No problem.
Time for us to bugger off now. Back to the hamster wheel of housework, errands, to-do lists, and possibly tantrums, me, not my kids. Our hearty thanks go to my long-suffering other half, Andy, for producing and editing Irregular Bitches, oh, to well, Chopasaurus.
Sorry.
I'll start it again. Our hearty thanks goes to Chopasaurus for our music and to our fabulous guest today, Dr. Fionnuala Barton, who you can find on Insta at The Menopause Medic. Please go follow. My final thanks go to lovely Lulu, one of the few people who can talk me off a cliff of burgeoning rage and always gets the last word in, and that is...
Stay cool, bitches.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.